Hello, it's Monday, September the 27th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Labour Party conference in Brighton. Coming up. Would you have a pony in the house? We'll be talking about people who do have more and more animals in their home. Smart motorways, more evidence that they're exactly the opposite of that. I'm going to be talking to the widow of a man who was killed on a smart motorway. At the Labour Party conference, they're trying to get back on track on policy by talking about scrapping the much maligned business tax, and also they're going to invest more money in green energy technology. But first, can't get away from it, it's the fuel crisis, and I'll be talking to the head of the Road Haulage Association. So there seems to be no let up in the fuel crisis, with up to 9 in 10 forecourts having run dry of fuel as the HGV driver shortage continues to affect supply chains. Competition laws have now been suspended by the government to allow businesses such as Shell and BP to share drivers. The Environment Secretary, George Eustace, however, says the government has no plans at the moment to use the army to drive petrol tankers. I'm joined now by Rob McKenzie, Managing Director for Policy and Public Affairs at the Road Haulage Association. Rod, do you see any light at the end of a tunnel, if you pardon the pun? Is there any sign that this is the government is getting a grip of this situation?
Well, Andrew, I'm an optimist, and there's a very faint glimmer in the very far distance. And what I mean by that is that it's great that the government has come up with a package. Unfortunately, we're not clear about what the detail in that package is. The short-term measures don't scratch the surface and probably aren't going to work. The longer-term stuff, well, that's the light at the end of the tunnel, because a lot of them are RHA suggestions, things that we've asked for years. And if we can make them work, there is hope.
Now, this driver shortage, it didn't just come overnight, so the government's been aware of the problem. I mean, I gather back as far as 2005, there was a shortage, and I saw a press release from, I think it might have been your organisation in 2015, Mr. McKenzie, warning of a shortage of 50,000 HGV drivers. So it seems successive governments have simply not dealt with this.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And 50,000 was a figure that we were using with the government in 2015, as you just said. And yet a government minister as late ago as last summer was accusing us of crying wolf over the driver shortage. It's come home. And really, now the government has woken up to it, and we need to do something about it urgently.
So the immediate measure short term, they're allowing 5,000 drivers to come in from the EU on temporary 3-month visas. But 5,000 is not going to scratch the surface, because my understanding is the shortage of drivers is closer now to 100,000.
You're absolutely right. It is a shortage of 100,000, and this does barely scratch the surface. The other thing is, you've got to think about a Eastern European driver here who is being told that they can apply for a visa, which might take about 3 weeks to process. Then they've got to find somewhere to live. Then they've got to resign from their existing job, presumably. And then they've got to take up a job in the UK. So suddenly 12 weeks has become 8 weeks or even less.
Yeah.
And there
yeah.
aren't many people who would uproot themselves in that way. And the Christmas Eve deadline is not real either, because most people would want to go home several days before that to be at home at Christmas. So it just doesn't really work.
And what are the long... The government appears to be ruling out as well, Mr. McKenzie, deploying the army, which I would have thought would have been quite a sensible thing to do, or unless, of course, they're worried about the optic of does this suggest a government that's lost control that it's had to send for the military?
Yeah, I mean, the optics are interesting, aren't they? Because, for many people, bringing in the army is a reassurance, and for others,
yeah.
it's a sort of a desperate measure. But let's just look at the numbers here. There are about 280 army lorry drivers who are qualified to drive fuel tankers.
Is that all? My word.
That's all. Now, there are more than that of army lorry drivers, but not the huge numbers that existed during the Cold War period, for example, when we had a logistics corps of maybe, certainly tens of thousands of army truck drivers and similar. So we're down to a tiny fraction of that. And the specialist nature of fuel tanker delivery, for which you need extra qualifications, and which are effectively, as it were, the elite of the industry, they could only boost the numbers by about 280.
Can I ask you just as well, on a personal level, you were singled out in our sister paper, The Mail, on Sunday yesterday, and Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, seemed to be winding it up, that in some way it was the fault of the Road Haulage Association for encouraging people to panic buy.
Well, firstly, the allegation against me is nonsense, because I was accused of leaking from a meeting that I hadn't been at. When I hadn't had a readout from that meeting, so I had no knowledge of what the meeting was. And when the story broke into the public domain and everyone knew about it, journalists phoned me up and asked me for comment. So I can't have been the leaker. I wasn't the leaker. And the second point is, when I did appear on television and other news outlets, what I said was, there is no shortage of fuel and there is no need to panic buy. What we do have is a shortage of tanker drivers, which is true. And all those statements are true. And therefore, it is difficult to see how the government can accuse me of encouraging panic buying.
Well, they're trying to pass the buck, aren't they? Just finally, Mr. Kenzie, we know a lot of big drivers have retired. They've got fed up with the pay had been falling by comparison to other jobs in supermarkets, for instance. I know Ocado are paying more money, IKEA are paying more money for drivers. Do you think there's any way that some of these drivers who retired recently, who are just fed up with it, might come back? Would that be a solution?
Well, we think it's worth a try. We think it's worth a shot. We think it's worth a letter, which we've suggested and which the government has agreed with now. But I don't think we'll get big numbers, because a lot of those drivers will be in their 60s or 70s, have retired for a good reason, and don't want to come back. And the other thing that puts lorry drivers off is something called the driver CPC, which is a classroom-based qualification. And lorry drivers hate classrooms. When you say, well, to come back, you have to do 5 days in a classroom to qualify as a lorry driver, a lot of them will tell us to go away, because they think that if they're doing this essential deliveries, they really don't need that sort of level of training when they've been, you know, a trucker for 30 years or whatever. So, you know, that is a big barrier to them. That's a factor as well.
Very interesting. Just finally, Mr. McKenzie, can you drive an HGV lorry?
No, I can't.
Oh, I was going to say, perhaps you could lead from the front and take one out and do some petrol deliveries, but a bit tricky if you can't drive, if you haven't got an HGV licence.
Yeah, it would take me about 6 or 8 months to get one, probably, with all the training and so forth and the cost, which I'd probably have to pay for myself, because we haven't really got a proper, quite the right mechanism in place to train people, but we're getting there, and we need to do some more work with the government, so long as they'll engage with us. About some of that detail. But, you know, I hope a lot of younger Britons will take it up. It's a vital public service job. It's tough. And we're trying to improve the facilities, roadside facilities, parking facilities, which you and I have spoken about before.
We have, yeah.
But it's a vital job, and we all need lorry drivers.
We certainly do. That's Rob McKenzie, Managing Director for Policy and Public Affairs at the Road Haulage Association. And somehow I think Mr. McKenzie will be talking about this for a few more weeks to come, don't you? Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The Labour Party Congress is underway in Brighton, and the party leadership is keen to get it back talking about policy rather than noises off about voting records and whether women have a cervix or not. The Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, announced today that a Labour government would cut business rates in England and then phase them out altogether if they form a government. They also want to boost the high street by axing what it views as an outdated tax that harms business. I'm joined now by Robert Palmer, who's Director of Tax Justice UK. Mr. Palmer, there'll be very little mourning for the demise of business rates. They seem to be pretty much universally loathed.
Yes, business rates are an upfront fixed cost on businesses, And it doesn't matter how profitable the business is, you have to pay them. And one of the other challenging things with the current system of business rates is that the high street shops end up paying quite a lot of business rates, while online firms like Amazon pay not very much. And so one of the things that Rachel Reeves announced is that she proposed cutting business rates for small and medium-sized companies in the short term, and paying for that by taxing big tech more, which I think would be a fairly popular move.
Yeah, good luck with taxing big tech more, because this government has promised it 100 times and they've never done it. I think David Cameron's government said they would tax big tech a lot more, never did it. I think Gordon Brown's government said the same. But just on the business rates, Mr. Palmer, can you explain why it adversely impacts more on a high street store than a big online business? Is it because the business tax is linked to the property?
Exactly. So business rates are paid as a proportion of the value of the business property that you're in. So if you're a big high street chain, you have lots of high street shops, you're paying a lot of business rates. If you're someone like Amazon, you have maybe a couple of warehouses and you're paying much lower business rates. And so it's one of the many ways in which the tax system is biased in favor of the online tech giants. And I think there'll be a lot of people out there, a lot of businesses that will be pleased with what Rachel Reeves announced. I mean, it was interesting. She announced that she and Labour would scrap business rates, but there wasn't very much detail on what was going to come after.
Well, that was my next question. You know, there was no detail of what would come after.
Yeah, as you say, there were some platitudes about some principles that it would be fair, that it would, you know, put an excess burden on small businesses, but very little detail. And I think that's going to be the challenge. Is business rates currently bring in £25 billion a year. That's a lot of money to find and replace with an alternative system. I mean, there were other things in her speech that I think is just worth pointing out. One of them is she was talking about how currently there are some very high earners, particularly in places like private equity, that end up paying lower rates of tax than ordinary workers to fix this problem. And again, she didn't really provide much detail. But I think she's perhaps trying to draw a bit of a line between Labour taxing wealth, taxing online giants, reducing taxes on small, medium businesses, government, which has just increased national insurance on everyone.
And just finally, Mr. Palmer, who sets the business rate? Is it each individual local authority according to the value of the property, or is it one of these terrible centralised taxes that's decreed from on high in Whitehall?
So there is a degree of localization to the way business rates are set and run, and some of the revenues go directly to local authorities. So there is also a question about, you know, local democracy and local control over local taxes that fund local services. And so, you know, it'll be very interesting to see the detail when Labour put out what they're actually going to replace business rates with. At the moment, we have a nice soundbite waiting to hear the detail on what that actually looks like in practice.
Absolutely. We'll look forward to it too. And we'll talk about it again, I'm sure. That's Robert Palmer, who's the director of Tax Justice UK. Thanks so much for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. 1 in 10 cameras on smart motorways are not working properly. That's according to a pretty shocking Daily Mail investigation. A Daily Mail reporter spent 6 weeks undercover at a control room. In one incident, a worker said, "We've got no signals, you're all going to die. Whichever God you believe in, start praying now." I'm joined by now Claire Mercer of Smart Motorways Kill, who tragically lost her own husband on the M1 in an accident involving a so-called smart motorway. Claire, if I could ask you just first of all, your reaction to the Mail revelation that so few of these cameras are working properly.
Well, it literally was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. I knew that the article was coming. I'd even spoken to the journalist at length. She told me some of what she found. But to actually read that incredibly long, detailed article when it went online at about 11 o'clock last night, I actually did break down, because I've not cried like that for 18 months now. And it broke my heart again. It was they haven't learned anything. They've not learned a thing. Even at the junction where Jason was killed, there's 25% of the cameras not working at the exact junction where he was killed. 2 years after a particularly horrible, it was one of the most horrific incidences in recent times there. And there was, it was that horrific. There was details kept back from the public. And yet they've learned nothing, or they can't even be bothered to maintain the equipment right where that happened.
And can you bear to talk about what happened to Jason there?
Yeah, I can tell you. I've repeated it enough times, unfortunately. He was on the motorway coming from Rotherham, just heading past Meadowhall in Sheffield. He had a minor bump with Alexandre Mergonier. They were at a sign that said no hard shoulder for 4 miles. 2 years ago, we knew less about smart motorways than we do now, so I don't even know. We'd never discussed them that I can remember. I don't know if he knew what one was. I don't know if he knew what he was meant to do. But he had a sign saying no hard shoulder for 4 miles. He knew it was his legal obligation to stop. So on the traffic cameras, you can see them travelling for quite a distance to try and find somewhere safe to stop, and they just can't. So they pulled over where they could. Alexandre was following Jason's lead. They pulled over where they could. They couldn't get right out of the live running lane because of the crash barrier, and they themselves couldn't go over the crash barrier because there was a 30-foot drop onto the slip road below. So they were stood exchanging details and taking pictures, and a HGV plowed into them and killed them.
Shock, absolutely shocking and terrible. And then, Claire, for you then to discover that at the actual point where your husband was killed, so senselessly killed, that there's no improvements.
No, I mean, there should have been things, the technology that's in place and should have been in place at the time, 2 years ago, should have picked up what was happening. So as soon as they stopped, they were right by a gantry. So even if the MIDAS system didn't pick them up, that's built into every smart motorway and should be able to tell when quite a lot of cars stop. So even though MIDAS didn't pick them up, we were at that point led to believe that the cameras were constantly monitored, and they actually said that if you stop, you will be picked up or we'll close the lane. So, you know, they I don't know if they knew that, but that's what was meant to happen. Even the cameras, you know, and now in inquests under oath, Highways England have to admit that their staff have got that many jobs to do, they're under that much pressure, that they don't monitor the cameras. The cameras are used after there's an incident. They're not used to stop incidences. So the MIDAS didn't work, the cameras didn't work, and SVD, which would have saved their lives, which can tell when just one or two cars stop, isn't fitted in 85% of smart motorways. So that wasn't there to work. So there's all these things that should have worked before they died and didn't. And then even after they died, it didn't work. Even when the whole motorway was backed up and there was horrific scene, you know, even then it didn't work. And it took the public phoning in saying, for the love of God, close the motorway.
Yeah. Claire, just finally, your hope must be, presumably, that the government finally see sense and just scrap these terrible things.
They've got to. How can they persist with this? I mean, we've been at them and at them and at them for 2 years, just us, you know, doing this. There's others that have been campaigning far longer, since well before I knew what a smart motorway was. But I have given up my job and I just do this all day, every day. I present the information, I collate it, I show it, I do interviews constantly. And this, they can't bat this back. And now, I mean, we were already arranging this protest. We're going to protest in Westminster, and we're not gluing ourselves to anything, and we're not going to block anything, I would like to add. But we are going to, we are planning a protest that will definitely get some attention. And, you know, I don't see how they can continue to push this out. I mean, I've already said that, you know, it's not manslaughter anymore, it's murder. And now, and even the police force admits this, and the police are looking into Highways England for corporate manslaughter.
Well, that's fascinating too, and I'm quite certain we'll be giving your protest, Claire, the coverage it deserves. Thanks so much for joining us, and yet again, commiserations on your loss of Jason. That's Claire Mercer, a Smart Motorways Kill. So there are an estimated 15,000 Shetland ponies in Britain, but some of these tiny horses actually live inside people's homes. Ali Stern owns a 17-year-old pony, Jack Brock, who loves to watch the racing on TV and even joins her children for tea parties. Now, Jack Brock is a therapy pony, so he pays other people home visits in return for a donation to Dementia UK, and which has raised £24,000 so far. Ali Stern joins me now. Ali, why does the pony like it so much in the house?
Well, I think he, first of all, always thinks of his tummy. So he knows he's going to get a treat when he goes indoors. That's the case when he visits these lovely care homes, is I have a basket full of carrots, which everybody then feeds him. So he knows when he comes in, he's going to get something. Otherwise, he'll march around and he's a little bit of a blunderbust. And it's better sort of to keep his attention by feeding him. So I think he just he enjoys that. And it's just having attention.
And lovely for your children.
Oh, especially in lockdown, it was wonderful because we're very lucky anyway, living on a farm, and we've got a nice sort of large garden. But entertainment-wise, it was hard for everybody, and Jack just provided endless entertainment. Even on rainy days, we had tea parties inside with their teddy bears and, of course, Jack. So, and even dressing up Bunny, my daughter, who's four. She loves dressing up, and of course she dressed up, and I've got a brilliant video of her on his Instagram, of her in a little dress with wings, just going off loose, marching around the kitchen, going sort of knocking chairs over, and I was half chasing her saying, please come back, Bunny and Jack, and they just marched round, and she said, Mummy, I'm fine, we're on an adventure. And I was thinking, oh, not in my house, please. So it was quite amusing.
Yeah, and people listening are going to, I think they're all going to be thinking the same thing, Ali, which is why I'm going to ask you about it. So if Jack Brock comes in the home, what happens if he does a whoopsie?
Well, he's never done one in our house. He
really?
Never, touch wood. Now I've said that, he'll mostly do it. I think because he's not in there for hours and hours on end. And he's not, normally a horse does a whoopsie if they're a bit anxious or something exciting. It's the same with a care home. When we turn up somewhere in the horse trailer, he thinks, oh, I've got somewhere, and realises we're there. And he does it straight away in the trailer. So it's done. And then after sort of an hour and a half of being in these care homes, which we often are, he's obviously devoured good 2 bags of carrots, which are and apples and some biscuits, because a lot of the dementia sort of residents will feed him a biscuit and things. Then I sort of do think, well, if it's gone in, it's got to come out, so we can go out in their courtyard gardens and things, and actually if I whistle, he'll spend a penny to a whistle.
How interesting. What a well-trained pony he is. Now, you're also an illustrator, I think, Ali, and you're doing something special for Christmas, I think, to raise money for Dementia UK.
Yes, so I come from a fundraising family background. My stepfather is Bob Champion, and he has...
Oh, yes, I know, he won the National.
Yeah, he did, and he has a fabulous charity, the Bob Champion Cancer Trust, and he's raised tens of millions. And he has a yearly Christmas card, Bob Champion Cancer Trust. And one year I painted it, and we sold 5,500 packs. There's sort of 55,000 of my cards floating around. And it gave me the real confidence to do my own for Jack, because it was a bit of a mistake me painting this card. I think somebody let him down at the last minute, and he saw I wasn't too bad at painting, so I ended up doing it. And it's just amazing how these sort of things happen. So I've painted Jack's cards for the last 2 years, and I've had huge support from local shops and sort of around me who know of Jack, who have sold them, and percentages of the Christmas cards go to dementia charities, and our biggest charity we support is Dementia UK.
Well, I think that's fabulous. My own father had dementia, so it's a charity I always like to support. Well, that's a lovely story, Ali, and we love your pony, Jack Brock, and may he continue to munch his carrots and continue to do the whoopsies in the trailer. That's at the illustrator and fundraiser, Ali Stearns. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.